Welcome to the Experience Focused Leaders Podcast. My name is Alex Shevelenko. I'm CEO and founder of Relate2, and we are on a mission, both with the podcast and with Relate2, to bring the most important ideas to life. And how do we do that? We do that through amazing, immersive, engaging experiences that move your organization forward, move your customers forward, and move us as a society forward. So if you love ideas, if you love bringing these ideas to life, stick around. Also, at the end of the podcast, we'll reveal how you could potentially be a guest speaker on the podcast as well. Let's get started. Welcome, Amit Pandey, enterprise product leader with over two decades of experience at Oracle, Yahoo, HP, and C3 AI, where he serves as GM and VP of their commercial AI applications. Welcome to the pod, Amit.
Thank you, Alex. Pleasure to be here.
Well, listen, we go way back. We share fascinations with bringing innovation in how go-to-markets gets done in enterprise use cases in particular. And you have a perspective of having been through many waves and being a pioneer on this topic. So what's happening right now with the go-to-market? Let's dive in. And what are the biggest changes that you've seen? And what have you seen that's staying the same?
A decade ago, if you'd asked me about go-to-market, I would have said, is that just marketing? Is that just sales? And I think one of the most exciting things over the arc of the last decade, right? Even sort of stepping into the AI world we're in, is that go-to-market has now become a foundational construct. I mean, it's actually quite inspiring to see how people now talk of go-to-market engineers and how everybody at OpenAI lists themselves as just working in GTM, whether they work on sales or marketing or, right?
Right, that's right. That's kind of obvious. But first thing is, like, most people 10 years ago didn't know what GTM stood for.
It
right?
didn't.
So it was not an acronym.
It was not an acronym. And I remember I used to work at Tact AI, right? The first AI sales assistant, a couple of moons ago. And my then boss, I remember talking to him and saying, we've got revenue and sales engineers and solutions, marketing, and everything else. And we should just be intern. This is, I'm talking 2017 now, right? And I remember talking to him and saying, we need to construct our own identity as go-to-market internally too, because isn't everything just go-to-market and product? And he was like, you're right. And I said, well, product thinks of itself as product in a more unified way. But, we need almost an identity evolution. And so I'm thrilled that go-to-market is something that is now, at least as VCs and PEs see it, and founders, like you see it, and the world sees it, it's a foundational construct. Now, what does this mean in terms of, what its implications are on what's changed and what's not changed, right? In terms of this means real dollar flow, right? Because dollar flow follows intent flow. And now, if you know that in order to get this company or institution up and running, you need a product. And if you have to now go distribute that product, explain that product, transact on that product, you need a way to do it. And that's go to market. It means that the tooling for it, the processes for it, the people for it, you got to start, thinking about it in that way. And I actually hope that the world of human resources and talent and the worlds of finance and G&A go through something like this in the future, because I feel go-to-market as GTM became more strategic. Yeah. And that means that the intent and money flow, sort of into it increased. Now, in terms of, I think what's specifically changed, I mean, the roles have changed, right? So it's interesting that you can almost create this, remember the Neanderthal turning into man kind of visual of back in the days when you would sort of have these stages? You can almost go from like sales ops, revenue ops, GTM ops, and now, kind of where GTM ops and AI have now started becoming something new. It's still GTM ops, but I do think that this is here to stay. And it's a good thing because you and I have been on the other side of having a conversation with marketing ops and sales ops, not even talking to each other.
They don't talk to each other. They rarely use the same tools. They use different metrics. And so I sort of think there's almost bifurcation. So there's some innovative organizations. They have this GTM, convergence. They have people. They're creative folks like yourself that kind of understands that sales and marketing are not enemies. They kind of and customer success and expansion is not an enemy. That's all kind of an integrated team. And then there is the reality that there's a lot of complexity. The marketing suite is complex on its own, right? It has a lot of specialties, right? Like email marketer versus that marketer versus like that is itself a beast. And then the organizations are designed differently. So there's organizations and tools. And so who's pulling those threads together?
What is
What,
also interesting,
yeah.
Alex, is that if you go to the Fortune 500 side of the house, they don't use the acronym GTM in the same way. People know the term go-to-market internally, but it's only when you start using, the word commercial. And you and I
Right.
was talking about this, walking into
Yeah.
this conversation, that commercial execution is the is kind of the adult language of go-to-market in a Fortune 500 context, but
Yeah.
It's the language that a chemical company, a mining company, and a life sciences company can all align around and say, oh yeah, that's what what we mean when we say commercial. So what's interesting to me is that I'll give you sort of three examples of what's changed, what's not changed, right? So
Okay.
in terms of what's changed is that the term commercial operations or the term go-to-market operations, that's changed. So that means there's new jobs there, there's new like tooling for that. But
Okay.
what's not changed is that both of them are still trying to ultimately solve the problem of how do I serve my customer better? And that's a good
Right.
thing,
Right.
right? That's a good thing because it means that you're saying that is this customer being acquired faster? Do we understand them better? Are we growing them better? And so at that point, if you were customer success and you were sort of seen as like a poorer cousin of the revenue org, like in a past sales world, actually you're now they're more important. I think the second thing that's changed is that look, the AI tooling is eating up legacy tooling, and certainly it feels like the systems of record are still safer because well, it's hard to rip out your intestines, right? And all these databases, well,
And let's
they're
just so like let's double click on that briefly. We'll come back to the broader point because there's all this thing like SaaS is dead and da da da. And like I think we need to distinguish what kind of SaaS, right? Is it kind of enterprise? Is it consumery things, right? Is it like and it, like you said, system of record? I don't know. Like I would not trust. I would not trust as much as I love Claude Pro and myself and our team uses all the everything and everything. I would not trust something that hasn't been vetted, to replace a system of record that has a lot at stake around it, right? Systems of
So
engagement is a different topic. We could talk about that, right? Like
that's a great point, Alex, because the system of payroll, the system of customer and sales records, and the system of your marketing campaigns and the system of your employee records, those systems are costly. They have been in place for maybe a decade, 2 decades, depending on sort of which function that you're in. And the reason the systems of engagement, and then there was this interim phase called systems of intelligence and so on, right, that we've kind of been through, these systems were meant to fulfill large gaps that the systems of record had left. But what's interesting in the AI tooling of the last couple of years is that people thought systems of record were going to be replaced. And as you rightly said, the systems of record are the only canonical truth you can actually rely on because at some point you need to know, what to trust to forecast your business or what to trust to, like know how many employees you have. Ironically, the systems of engagement and the systems of intelligence, I think there's been more downward pressure on those because, in some sense, without being as philosophical, intelligence is an interim sort of state that ultimately leads you to action of some kind, right? And so I think it was unsustainable that there are going to be systems of record, engagement, intelligence, and systems of action. I think everyone knew that the systems of engagement or the systems of record needed to become systems of action. And I think what AI has done, which is interesting, especially in the last year with the choose your flavor of multiple agents working together in orchestration, is that they've said, well, wait a minute, ultimately, your system of record could be your CRM, but it could also be your email, it could also be your Slack, it could be all of these places where things happen. But ultimately, what you're really trying to do is to connect point A to point B. So the term systems of orchestration is quite a mouthful, but it is true that I think what's changed is that the systems of orchestration are really evaporating a lot of the layers that had emerged on top of the systems of record. So I actually think where we're like headed is going to be, and I suspect that this is going to happen in the world you're in as well, which is that you have all these like repositories, but like ultimately you're trying to
Activate somebody. You like
activate
you,
somebody.
yeah.
Exactly.
So let me share a story, and I'd love to get your reaction. So you guys are at C3. You enroll in your employee benefits. Around November of this year. This takes care of your family health and benefits and wellness and retirement and whatnot. And this is a great thing for most US companies. And so one of our customer types that Emerge at Relate to are the brokers that support companies like C3 and like in their benefits program rollout. And so their deliverable was a guide and a lightweight portal explaining the benefits, activating, and then getting people to sign up for the right benefits and seeing the value in those benefits. And then throughout the year, I get to use them. And it was fascinating to see that, first they needed a system of records, just like, here's all the information, all your plans, all from health to medical, to dental to whatever, you've got everything in one place. That's a system of record. And then, of course, then they want, well, but if I just dump a database of PDFs in front of people, that's not going to help them make any decisions, feel the value of that huge investment we're putting in into benefits as a company. And so they started saying, well, can we have a summary, like a benefits guide that introduces it? And so that was the first thing where it became interactive. It's a presentation. It's a, like always on, leave behind. And then inside that, they now embed calculators around how to do your 401k. So you start interacting with it. And then of course it immediately drives you to go sign up or go use whatever benefit that you need to right away. And so it was beautiful to see that it's sort of a system of record for what's the deliverable for these brokers, for the clients, and sort of sometimes these get audited and whatnot. System of engagement and education, and then system of interaction, which is a slightly more evolved version of engagement, I'd say. And then ultimately, what's the conversion event? And that's multiple conversion event, right, throughout the year. And it was really obvious to us that once we saw that thread, we realized, well, this is a really high value customer group for us, because they've got the full stack and we could really add value to them. And pulling that stack in one place, it would be impossible, right? Like you can't get that with a kind of a database type of or file storage type of system, right? It just was not designed for that kind of evolution. So it seems like my lesson from this is that this type of thing is going to happen much easier in smaller clients that maybe don't yet have as much complexity. And so they could kind of say, hey, here's a concrete use case. I have a system of record, system engagement, action, all in one place. I still struggle to see how you could, you know, create a single integrated product that does all of this in much more, you know, complex use cases. It feels messy, and it feels like you'll still need a lot of, you know, very conservative development approaches to combine that. What have you seen? Like, have you seen the difference in this adoption across company types or industries? And, you know, any patterns you could, you know, predict going forward?
The really interesting thing outside of high tech, software, sort of 50-mile radius of Silicon Valley, you know, around here, or any of the kind of similar to Silicon Valley ecosystems around the world, is that the high tech companies, and you know, you and I have both worked at different high tech companies that are actually somewhere in these stacks. You know, high tech was really an anomaly. I mean, the vast majority of the industries out there, including the industries that are focused industries for you, the insurance industry, the life sciences industry, the manufacturing, metals, aviation, aluminum, you know, steel, those industries are actually extremely underserved by technology. And so what I've seen, which has been eye-opening to me, is that you have this paradox, okay? Most of the companies in these industries, they have certain systems of record that their CIOs are aware of, their CFOs are aware of. They know they purchase these over time. They know that they need these systems literally because without that, it's hard to be responsible in a fiduciary way, right? Yeah, so you need
it's almost a compliance.
Yes.
It's a compliance process thing that doesn't get you fired.
It doesn't get you fired. But the paradox is that you don't really expect that system of record to do anything more than that. So in fact, you know, when a lot of startups say, hey, you know, I'm going into this company which has 27 instances of Salesforce or 7 marketing automation tools, and you know, will they have appetite to use something new? The answer most of the time is that actually they don't really even think about these systems of record because they have now it's a certain kind of learned helplessness, right? Where these companies have acknowledged that I need one of these things, and you know, actually, I'm talking to you because I want you to tell me what to do with all of this like foundational information that exists in these databases. Because by the way, while Silicon Valley companies were, you know, buying systems of engagement and intelligence from each other over these last 10 years, we didn't buy most of it. So the interesting
thing is, hold on, let's pause on this. I mean, because this is a beautiful nugget. I kind of intuited that same from our journey, is when I'm like in Silicon Valley, we're talking about like a point solution that sits on top of another point solution that optimizes a third point solution, because they're all buying the stuff and it's all, you know, very open to innovation. Maybe they believe that software will solve all their problems because they're themselves software companies, right? And there's this openness to try things. And there's like a whole like thought leadership funnel of people talking about this, right? Like Marketo sold first to people in that kind of tech universe. And so it's always like very, very specific, and the users are educated, and it's maybe like in a way good, but very narrow. You just get niched. And then you step out of that universe, and it's like a completely different conversation, that because, as you pointed out, they're just like maybe at the foundational level, and they have a lot of information, and then they haven't like applied it to do great things for their business. And so the question is, what propels these slow moving folks that didn't adapt that earlier layer? What is changing now? Or is this going to be more of the same? Was like maybe a little bit, they do some AI experiments, you know, it was the CIO budget, because they need to do it in order not to get fired.
I think what's fascinating is that if you look at there's an analogy here, right, to draw from the relay to world, which is that when we experience, you know, Universal Studios, Disney, Everybody's, once a year, let's just go out to a movie theater and have this amazing movie experience that the whole family kind of goes and watches. All the best ideas of multimodality, immersiveness, personalization, enterprise at some point started opening up to these ideas because we couldn't really live in a black and white world at work and then this amazing world of Technicolor at home, right? And so a lot of the best ideas that were around us in society and ideas that we were experiencing as consumers, we were seeing these in our cars, we were seeing these, with our banks, we were seeing these in our iPhones. And at some point, the dam had to break and enterprises had to build more user-friendly software and so on and so forth. I think the same thing's happening in the world of these large organizations with the sort of year four or year five of the post-Chat GPT moment that we're in, right? I think this is a real phenomena that these companies that for the longest time were looking at Silicon Valley with sort of dual mode, right? They were looking at Silicon Valley companies that were buying all this tech and looking at it from the perspective of some jealousy and then some almost I would say skepticism. And both of those, by the way, were very justified emotions, right? Because Silicon Valley companies were growing at a different margin profile. And they were growing at a different, kind of growth profile. So let's say if you were Palo Alto Networks, or Zscaler, and you were buying, Salesforce Einstein, and then replacing that with Clari, and then Gong, and then Avizo, and then Salesloft, and all of these, then if you were Honeywell and you were looking at Palo Alto Networks, you were saying, well, Palo Alto can do this because Palo Alto is growing in a different way, and we're Honeywell. We are also older, more public, so we can't grow in the way Palo Alto does. But really, like, what is Palo Alto doing with all these technologies? I mean, is it really driving more revenue or efficiencies for them? Now, fast forward, guess what's happened? And the reason I use sales tech as an example and rev tech as an example because you and I are both familiar with what has happened in those companies, right? Clari and Salesloft, merged and had some kind of an unnatural baby in the basement of a private equity company, right? So that plays over. Outreach hasn't grown much. The only company in revenue technologies that are like really growing are either Gong, which has done a remarkable job of staying independent and crossing 300 million, or there's companies like my past employer Avizo, which have basically stayed like really close to the ground, haven't raised a lot, but have like now done 50, 60, 70 kind of million because they've said, look, let's focus on giving seven times more product to these companies. And so now, if you were Honeywell, you were waiting for the world to change. And I think what's interesting about what changed in the world is actually not just the technology, Alex, right? Look, the technology showed you and me and everyone that's twice our age also that look, this ChatGPT thing is real and you can use LLMs to do summarization and so on. But I think what it also showed them is that they could build their own stack in a more meaningful way than they could do in a previous era. And I think that this is actually the biggest change, right? Like when I now talk to these companies, they're not evaluating all of the opportunities in front of them when they're talking to a Databricks or C3 or they're talking to Salesforce. They're not just looking at these companies as what can I buy? They're looking at these technologies and saying, what can I buy that I can build upon in a way that I couldn't do even 2 years ago? And
So
I
it's
think
kind
that
of the full circle of this no code kind of thing that got started, where you're building an almost a no code platform, you're buying it, but the idea is that you're building it to create your own content. And so now you're looking that like across, that was kind of maybe top of the stack or a couple layers of the stack. Now you're looking at that much more broadly. Is
By the way,
that
though, I love that you use the word content here, right? Because in many ways, if you can deploy agents and you can deploy apps in the way you think about deploying content, which every company, if you ask them, like, are you comfortable deploying content in your organization? They would say, I'm comfortable deploying content. But if you say, are you comfortable deploying apps? They'd say, oh my God, we had this mobile app store era. And you remember the you know, internal company app stores, none of that ever took off. And I think this is where, like, the question, you know,
But why? What, like, here's a why. I think people underestimate the power of PowerPoint way back in, you know, Office Suite, because that was, you know, certainly Excel was the first kind of content slash app builder
that's right.
that actually, you know, really been truly democratized in the enterprise. And, you know, maybe poorly, maybe not was the best templates, maybe it was like a, you know, feedback loop that's kind of properly working underneath. But I think there is many years to the plate there, which is really different than an app, right? Unless you've been building maybe like Excel. Some people have been using Excel as apps, right? Like effectively selling, you know, in consulting, and I'm sure you've done this in the pricing world. Like you kind of build a, you know, a sophisticated Excel model, kind of put a nice wrapper around it so
it's
people don't
by
see
the way,
the cells. This
in
has
the
been
world
an
of
app for 20 years, right?
It's been an app for 20 years. I can tell you that if you look at pricing as an example of an area that like really large Fortune 500 companies are looking to invest more in and get, you know, the pricing tools that work for them for their internal pricing, you know, analysts and such, the incumbency is not is not off the shelf products, because if you're in Novartis or AMD, well, there's no one who could have built a pricing application for you. Your worlds are too different, right? It's actually Power BIs, which were next generation versions of the same Excels that you just spoke about,
exactly.
Right? That, I mean, essentially what you're replacing when you go in with new AI technologies in most of the cases, you're replacing, you know, what, you know, Bob the Builder and their teams over the last 10 years had maybe built up a few dozen Power BIs, more than a few dozen versions of spreadsheets, and probably a few, you know, Snowflake, Salesforce, SAP type systems underneath that are like connected to these. So for them to replace that, you know, you're not just trying to replace the interface layer, right? You're trying to replace the logic, the interface layer. And if you think about, you know, within those systems, what's going to die? Well, the Power BIs and the Excels have natural limitations, but you there's still no magical way, by the way, to take those Power BIs and Excels and then suddenly create an agentic application out of it. But the reason why I think the mobile app era inside enterprises largely failed, and the reason a lot of the web app eras, the web apps era inside enterprise, you know, outside of the systems of record also didn't go as far, is because it actually goes back to something very fundamental to your like mental model around Relay 2, right? Which is that, just like this conversation, in the real world, someone has a specific need that is activated in themselves. Now, that need is often around an answer or a resource that you're looking for. And so if you're using Expensify, you're basically going to use it to scan, upload, and tag, and then you're never going to use Expensify. Okay, and that's, by the way, Expensify is a use case that's real, right? It's a real use case. Everyone has to manage it when they do this. If you could get away with, so the friction was, you're now downloading this Expensify app from an internal app store in the company, and you're downloading another 51 of those applications, and those applications have maybe 25 screens, but guess how many of those screens you're actually using at any given point in time too. So I actually think you could, if you turn the heat up, you know, kind of, I think in the, you know, in kind of French style slow reduction, right? Like you did a reduction technique and you said, let us just put all the web applications and mobile applications of the previous era on a slow boil. And let's come back in a couple of days and see how many real core value screens are needed by users. You'll find that the same power law applies, that people are actually using maybe 1% of those screens. So now fast forward to the agentic world, where in your amazing example, by the way, of like, you know, how to choose 401k plans, or like, you know, should I do Kaiser or should I do PPO, you know, classic California question, right? As you think through those, I actually think the reason why generative AI was a false start is because generative AI created this very, I would say, like, slightly fake use case. Talk to your PDF and, you know, talk to this agent. But people want guidance. And now the layer of interaction that you mentioned, right, where, whether it's through full control to the user versus kind of you slide it to the right and you have this concierge like thing that's kind of guiding you and saying, wait a minute, let's talk about your teeth, you know, like let's talk about what kind of dental plan's right for you. If we can give people that 1% that makes a material difference to their life, then it's easy enough to fire the previous generation of software. And I think that's, you know,
well,
that's
let's kind of dig into that, right? Like we were talking about kind of mission critical decisions in your life. And so like, for example, in this benefits use case, it was a total eye opener for me that the killer apps were for people who wanted to understand what the fertility benefits were. Or if they wanted to have a kid, you know, what's the kind of best, richest, kind of most valuable option in kind of having, you know, next that they could be covered on in terms of a plan. And these questions were so important that for the first time, these HR folks that were administering this, that where they were able to answer them instantly, you know, from 150 page PDFs where you would normally try to get some control F answers, right? And then the AI, you know, in an AI conversation allows to unlock it. Then you drill into the specific pages. So you have the context, you know, that ability turned this from a, you know, something that I deal with in HR type of thing, that it's a thing, to wow, right? Like I am going to work my ass off for this company because, you know, this health plan that addresses that they're investing in anyway, that now I've selected, that is going to allow me to fulfill my life dream as a mother or as a father or whatnot, that is, you know, unlocked, right? And so to me, that's sort of this dream of content that's actually coming to life, where it's like it was the, you know, you're going from information packaging and maybe sharing to actually like solving a life problem for an individual that works at the company, solving a problem for a company where it's sort of like, it's not doing this thing for nothing. It wants it, you know, its employees happy and engaged and, you know, really like pushing it in a great way. So that's sort of the story behind the benefits. And then for these brokers who are selling a commodity was no, like, I love it, but like they're great, amazing people, but basically they differentiate themselves in service. And now this is the service in the AI era, right? That they're able to deliver and they say, hey, look, these are the stories that they tell now to their clients. Or when they bring the RFP, they say, here's how we don't hide behind small print in our RFP. You could chat with it, you know, deep dive into relevant sections. And if you like this approach, by the way, that's the experience that we deliver to your employees when they're looking for your 200-page benefits guide. So it's sort of, so, to your point earlier that we discussed, sort of start, you start serving your customers. You start serving your customer's customer. And all of a sudden, that's the game changer that these PowerPoints were never meant to really deliver, right? All of a sudden, they become the PowerPoints, the PDFs, the Excels become apps that are game changing for the brokers, right? And they need to do it, and it's no longer something that is, you know, for a relatively conservative industry, this is no longer science fiction, right? This is now becoming a, I would say, competitive necessity to keep up with a, you know, relatively conservative market. So this is what I see in sort of the regulated verticals that have been stuck typically in being late adopters, right? And I think you at C3, you guys are also known for kind of not necessarily always going for the software tech, right? By focusing on these huge mega industries that are, that have their own adoption challenges because they're deeply regulated and have certain ways of how they do things. What have you seen that's in like specifically regulated world that's taking off that maybe is less relevant in unregulated world as you kind of humanize this AI solutions and bring it to market?
If we go from the bottom to the top, right, the one of the most interesting starting like troubles that any regulated company has, and I would say that at the extreme end there are like everyday companies that are facing similar challenges to these regulated industry companies as well. It's that everybody has a lot of guilt and shame about their data, right? There's a
Really,
lot of
yeah.
like guilt. I think there's a lot of guilt and shame around like, well, in our world, like, that type of data has always existed in this repository, and we have all of these other repositories that have certain access patterns that are like maybe it's not normal at all, unlike things you've seen and so on. And I think that
Our SharePoint sucks. I'm sorry. Like we
yeah, I
know
mean,
it, right?
actually,
Like
SharePoint's a great example, right? Because if you ask the 10, 15-year younger version of me, I would have said, "Oh my God, SharePoint!" And today, I said, oh, "You know what? I mean, I love the SharePoints and Teams world. Like, it's not like I miss Slack with not using Slack for many years because you start going towards value, right? And you start differentiating between kind of sometimes showmanship and like real value. And what I think is interesting is that for these companies, if someone can help them with letting their data be where that data is, rather than requiring an upgrade on their technologies or an upgrade on their people, or there is an upgrade in the thinking, right? Like, which is that, listen, in order for us to serve you better, we do need to bring your data from where your data is, into a blob instance or into a Snowflake instance or into some other instance. And if your data cannot be brought into an instance because it's on the edge, we'll figure out a way to work with there. So actually, the most I would say like boring conversations around compliance, security, sort of the if you call it the FedRAMP certifications and all of this. This is actually the starting point for a lot of these companies, and I think that it's a it's something that if you're a vendor in that space, right, and you have the first the understanding that there's a lot of fear, guilt, greed, and such that is associated with this, and you put the right people in that point in the conversation, well, you're addressing the biggest elephant in the room, which is that my data may not even be ready for you to do anything with it with regards to to AI. Okay, number one. Number two, if you can use AI, and I think this is where there's very few companies that have figured this out. I'm a huge fan of this kind of AI-based forward deployed engineer model, right? Where it's not just me as an FTE coming in, but it's you or me with a backpack of AI tools coming in and saying, listen, Alex, let me take a guess. You have a lot of duplicate data. And you're like, yeah, absolutely, we have a lot of duplicate data. How are you going to address my duplicate data? And I say, listen, what if I deploy agents and new data pipelines in my kind of plumbing that help us catch your duplicate data before we ingest this data into our platform? At this point, I'm actually addressing your bad data, stale data, duplicate data problems. I actually think that's really important to get right in a regulated industry because without that, it's kind of a non-starter. And I would say that one of the reasons, Alex, why a lot of the traditional systems of record failed, and I'm not talking about Aviva, right? Like, which was built for that world. But I'm talking about even kind of where the Salesforce ServiceNow world initially struggled, and certainly most of the horizontal apps in Silicon Valley struggle, is that they try to force the customer's process around them rather than go specifically to where the customer is with purpose-built tooling, kind of people who can talk that domain language, like the GM model that you mentioned. And then okay, now let's you go further up the stack, right? Okay, what does everybody want on top of that? Okay, look, even if you live under a rock today, you're probably doing something in your regulated industry with MCP protocols. Joe and his boys have probably deployed a couple of test agents on the inside. So when you go in with this open conversation and you say, listen, we know you've done a bunch of MCP experiments. We know you've done a bunch of agents. We know you've probably also deployed some agentic apps. If you bring, now that we've solved the data problem, now that we're talking about the workflow level above the data, let's first of all have an honest conversation and say, I'm not going to ask you to kill your agents. In fact, you can bring all your agents in. And if you're using SAP's agents and Agentforce's agents, you can bring those agents in and let's coexist with those agents so that we can give you the control layer to then deploy the next 1,000 agents. I think that's an honest conversation. Honestly,
right.
A year or two ago, I think everyone was kind of, you know, dangling. I mean, I have an old kind of BMW key here, right? Like everyone was dangling this key of like, here's this one master agent. And you and I know that, you know, it's still too early to call whether there's going to be 10 super agents inside an organization or one supervisor agent and like a dozen agents under them that are specialized. It's still early, right? So if you think that the company you're talking to in this regulated industry is only going to deploy one agent, well, then you're definitely being naive because...
Well, the more regulated it feels like, the more there are legacy approved workflows.
Correct.
Which means it's going to be harder to put the one super agent. I think exactly. Like at a startup, like I think that's where the sort of buzzwords come in. Like, yeah, okay, great. I'm a founder and I'm, you know, building, you know, Alex, you know, I'm built, you know, I build the agent for CEOs of startups, right? Like that I get, right? Like whether I use it or not is still a big question. But I think when you get to that level of sophistication and workflow and needs for approval, I think what you're saying makes a lot more sense to me is like you kind of need to coexist with what's already there because this is not your industry that's like, oh, great, latest shift in AI technology, I got to jump on it, right? I think they want to do it, but they have to respect the existing workflows. And that means this integration play is more likely. And I guess the broader question is like, where do you see, if there are going to be pockets of innovation within the regulated world, where do you see those happening? Right.
Actually,
we're talking about, yeah.
This is a great question, right? Because you know, the innovation in the simplest use cases, there's a lot of mileage for that to run today, right?
Yeah.
I can tell you that I've probably looked at a few dozen AI council presentations or kind of, you know, our internal AI czar and, you know, how we're thinking at a variety of Fortune 500 companies over the past year. And I noticed this interesting pattern that either the companies had already formed an AI council and they were trying to figure out the right mix between innovation and governance, because you got to run enough experiments at the edge, but also you have to govern those experiments,
right,
kind of
that's
with
right.
cost controls. Or there were companies that were literally going to have that meeting in November, December, or like now on, oh my God, we're, you know, launching this AI council. And in fact, I remember talking to some of the sales leadership, you know, both in my organization, but also outside, and saying, you guys need to figure out how you're going to have that AI council conversation, because you'll need to figure out, you know, in very polite terms, whether this is an AI council that is, you know, that is a, you know, a set of people that have self-appointed themselves as bureaucrat in this large company to, you know, kind of throttle AI, or is this actually a real council with budgetary power, at which point this is almost like an economic buyer for you, and you got to model that out into your, you know, into your sales and commercial process. And so if you look at the number of contacts with my customer, each contact with my customer, whether I'm having that contact, you know, in a kind of an agentic sense or through a content workflow, improving efficiencies around those, improving complaint resolution, you know, improving kind of almost what you would call the quality of serving of those customers, you know, perennial, ancient problems.
Yeah.
The amount of innovation that can be brought there, you know, with agents today, I actually think that's the first starting point of innovation, because what happens is that you're taking an existing problem that is already connected all the way at the top with, you know, something that's a board level metric. And once you've proved that, so let's just say the customer contact problem, right? How
so
often
customer call, so for lack of a better word, this is a customer call center, right? Or that's right now, that's expensive human, you know, maybe not deep experts in what you're doing, referring to manuals to answer those questions. And so you're saying, hey, we can productize and, you know, delegate high complexity questions to individuals and then have immediate answers through
right. And
AI
you can flip that same thing onto the other side of the funnel and say that, look, you know, with my 5,000 salespeople and with the marketing budgets that I have, which, you know, often with the large companies you work with as well, you know that a lot of that marketing budget is actually trade shows, events, you know, kind of billboard spend. So the amount of marketing spend that's actually going into digital innovation and digital technologies in a lot of these larger companies, you know, as a function of, you know, like spend going into trade shows is still lower than it needs to
got
be,
it.
Right?
So if it's a butterfly, you're saying like I got like one part of the butterfly and another part of the butterfly, top of the funnel and the very bottom, those kind of are relatively easy. What about the middle? Kind of where you need more, you have more complexity.
I think in the middle, this is where you know, drawing a line from your example of benefits, the AI assistance, guidance, you know, kind of expert AI by your shoulder, helping your existing salesperson or your existing, you know, product and solutions person, I think that middle has a lot of room for not, you know, automation of the process, but augmentation of the process of the human, mm-hmm. right? So let's take an example. Now, if I am in a sales cycle with you, you're a life sciences VP of marketing, and you've been told that Amit might have some ideas on how to improve the effectiveness of your new drug launches. And you want one of those new drug launches which moves your stock up by 10%, right? And you're like, listen, man, I mean, I've used a bunch of these like tools from like whatever Veeva and all these other companies, but, you know, none of this that does like new drug launch orchestration for me. Like, because new drug launch orchestration in the life sciences world is like a 6-month process versus, you know, Salesforce announcing Agentforce in like, you know, 2 weeks and then everyone moves on, right? Software launches are probably juvenile as compared to like new drug launches in the biopharma world. Now, at some point, if I show up and I give you my first call deck of 7, you know, pages, let's just say I'm a Series C, you know, startup and I have some credibility and, you know, I have a Stanford medical guy on my board and whatever, right? Mm-hmm. But I show up in a conversation with you, I show you maybe 6 or 7 pages, and then I show you a standard demo, it is almost entirely guaranteed to fail, right? Why? Because I don't really understand your specific problem. But now, instead, imagine a new sales process, right? Where I'm in this conversation, I haven't even showed you a deck, okay? Let's just say I started my meeting with a relay to, and I showed you maybe 3 vignettes, okay? And I said, here's kind of how you think about the world, and it gets you convinced enough to start talking. And you say, well, you know, Amit, the biggest problem that I have is that, you know, I actually think we're doing all the right things. But, you know, my problem is that we do all these right things and then we have a 1-week spike and then crickets, right? If I could make that 1-week spike a 1-month spike and now the whole world knows about my new drug, is that something you can solve for me? Now, imagine you telling me that in the first 20 minutes of a 45-minute call, right?
Right.
The way I can manage the sales process with AI differently today is that instead of me saying, Alex, let's set up a call after you're back from the holidays with Janet from my team in Colorado, we're going to do... You know, no. You're hot in this moment. Now, imagine if I could, in the same conversation, say, you know, let me show you an example of what this could look like. And meanwhile, the tool that's next to me, and let's just say I have a solution person also with me on the call, they're listening to you and they've vibe coded an example dashboard on our platform of something that could look right for Luma. Let's say that's your new drug. And I say, Alex, in the spirit of showing you something, you know, that relates to your world, can I show you something, you know, my colleague Jake, who's also on the call. Yeah. Meanwhile, Jake is using an AI tool, right? And Jake shows a dashboard which at least looks 75%, like what your ideal world looks like. At this point, you know that the empathy with which I'm approaching this isn't just words. I've just showed you something that is different from the 17 other vendors that you've been talking to. So I think that
That's
in the middle.
beautiful. I love this example. You kind of remind me of something that I love doing on some of our calls is like we discuss what are your, for example, biggest content problems. And the person inevitably says, well, I have this thing that I'm launching, this, our annual report or like this ebook that is like for marketers. And they share it with us, right? Like they kind of start sharing. It's like, and it's kind of like, I wish I knew more data about it, or it was more whiz bang and exciting, and it kind of helped us stand out and really get our message across to our buyers faster. And so we kind of just, I've done it myself, or if you have, like you said, like a sales expert on the call or CS expert, you can do it, they could do it while you're talking. But generally, like the wow factor happens when on that call, you're basically transforming that. And we've even done like a time clock for one time. It was like, okay, well, here's your document. Let's just count the seconds and we'll come back to it in whatever, in 2 minutes and see what this person has done behind the scenes.
Like building up anticipation to.
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of like, and it was so much, and it's fun, right? Like basically what you're changing, yeah, you're selling, but also you're just having a real engaging, non-bullshit slideware show, but like a real conversation on something that people care about, right? Because that's sort of the key word that you brought up, right? You're going from a theory into like something I deeply care about, and it's fun, right? Like I think that's the whole nature, I think, of what sales could change. And we're talking about how you could change, AI could change things. It's right. Like bored people receiving boring materials. That's traditional B2B, right? And sometimes it connects because you find the person who's like really, excited about that problem, and they'll power through your boring materials, but not all the time, right? Not as often as you would like. And so you end up with a bunch of stalled opportunities and people, like meetings that go nowhere. And imagine you kind of are able to make it exciting and then get people out of there like, oh, another meeting on Zoom, that it kind of doesn't shake me up. And you whether through your personality, but hopefully through your product as well, you're able to ingest somebody inside this, old-fashioned industry or a really mature industry with like the possibility of how their world could be transformed and how they could be an enabler of that change for their organizations. And to me, that feels like that's the big opportunity that like bringing, GTM tooling and also itself, the kind of the AI, the new AI generation products. Like, I think the sort of need for ability to have instant value in these complex industries and complex use cases, which normally take years to deploy, is part of the game changer that sort of almost is more important than the AI, right? It's sort of the velocity of change that is now unlocked through AI, right? But if it was something else that it was unlocking, it doesn't matter, right? It's just like unlock the velocity for people that have historically struggled because of the nature of their industry to move fast.
And now to close that call, right, like that you and I are on, now if you in the last 5 minutes open up and you say, guys, I've got to be honest with you, I tried this Boston-based startup last year, and 6 months in, we didn't really have a very good experience because they got acquired, and then I was like, oh my god, like I'm running this POC with you, and now your kind of your own future has changed, and so at this point you're opening up a vulnerability in your world, but you're just being honest about saying, you know what, I have this kind of unfinished project that I did with that other startup, and I actually tried solving this problem last year. So, remember a burnt prospect that was burnt by somebody else.
Is your best
like,
customer.
Well, you're kind of, they're an interesting customer because and if I say, well, I have an example of, somebody we worked with that's, not in your industry, but they're in a different industry. Maybe it's not exactly biopharma. Maybe it's a, different in a health insurance or something. And, we help them migrate from, their existing vendor to us. And, one of the ways we were able to help do that is because we've kind of built this tool that makes data migration possible in 36 hours. Now, at this point, you're going to be like, I do want to follow. Getting the follow-up meeting is actually the hardest problem. Now, as you rightly said, like, the way I measure that in my CRM and I track like how many meetings happened and so on and so forth, that's all just digital exhaust being captured. The real victory or failure is happening in this, conversation. And I think that you remember, gosh, man, like 20, 30 years ago, the lovely movie Ratatouille, where like the chef,
the French,
and he's the
that
critic,
was doing
right?
It. Yeah.
Yes, the critics in the restaurant, and the critic eats the two, and the critic is transported into like their grandmother's cooking, right? And that's because they've just had the soup. And the soup's of course being built by the rat that's in the kitchen, and by the human, but the human's a noob, right? And it's actually the spice mix is the genius rat, and it's those special peak moments, right? And
yeah.
And I think the reason why I'm very bullish about where the world of kind of AI generated content experiences is headed is because the way you elevate the mood and the consciousness of that entire process is you have to show something that people look at and say, you know what, that was really interesting. Like, I learned something and you made me feel better, about this call. And that kind of sales conversation always has the next meeting. And so I actually think we're like in this conversation, like with marketing and kind of content, right?
Yeah.
I actually think this is going to be more and more of the sales process going forward. I mean, I'm 100% convinced about this.
So what you're saying is, look, and obviously we're slightly biased in this agreement, but it's about elevating the experience when you have humans involved, so that it really is like you feel like you're genuinely solving problems. It's not some kind of linear monologue that you're stuck with, right? Like you're really uncovering things, and then you're not like waiting for like 15 cycles of meetings. You kind of get the confidence that, hey, look, this is a media problem, but these people, I see a path how this could make an impact on my organization, make an impact on my career, and sort of turning something that's abstract into real. So that's part of the experience. Here's the big question. How does this happen if you're not in the room, if you're not having this meeting? Before the meeting, people are doing, as we know, like a lot more discovery is happening through digital channels, for talking to chats. And then obviously after the meeting, the real decision maker oftentimes is not the person that was in the meeting, right? And they need to make an assessment, kind of experience a little bit of what you had in the meeting, and so that they could, bless it, or at least can get the right folks on board. And I feel like this art of sales has been very good at the meeting historically, right?
That's right.
Like you work for Mr. Siebel, brought you into C3, like created like the ultimate sales person as well, right? Like, so that's been done well. Obviously, it's changing now, as we discussed. But the art of education that doesn't bore you to tears, or the kind of like deeper follow-up versus some email chase, for booking the next meeting, that's been struggling in my assessment. And I don't see that it's changed at a 10x multiple in any meaningful way. What have you seen? And what is your kind of recommendations for people that want to innovate in the sort of when you're not in the room mode?
One of the most bullish areas for me about AI is that AI allows us to create these meaningful moments and experiences when either a human is not in the room because they couldn't be there in that meeting, or frankly, there's just not enough humans who can be in those rooms, in those conversations. And so what I'm bullish about is as AI gets more multimodal and AI starts taking on perhaps the best versions of what we can all do as we, you know, sort of, you know, the best parts of Alex and Amit may or may not be the way we look, right? It may be our embodiment of our ideas in an AI. You know, where you say, what, I spoke to this AI and it kind of felt like I was talking to you.
Yeah,
I think that treating the buyer very intelligently and knowing that when the buyer is in discovery mode, you need to give them a very sort of like an old world shopping experience, right? Where they feel not hassled, they feel not watched, they feel like the entire store. I mean, you know, if you've you know, in Europe and Asia, when you're buying like jewelry or like clothes for like, you know, important family things or weddings or whatever, you get that experience, right? Because you're in a place where there's no technology, but the people have reoriented themselves to showing you 500 products if that's what you want to see, because they're just warming you up to get you into the mood to buy. Because they know when you buy, you will probably buy a lot more than you originally intended to buy. And so I think in very specific terms with AI being used to serve up content, apps, calculators, utilities, toys, or build almost a simulated world of what you sort of need, I think that the website has to carry a lot more weight in where we're headed, because one, the website is going to be seen by APIs and AIs also, and the website is going to be seen by humans also. So you kind of have to, you know, like...
You have to meet both needs, right?
You have to meet both needs.
Yeah.
And I think that with short-form video, whether those videos happen to be TikTok-style AI, you know, of that version of you or me, like wearing the Spock start, you know, Trek uniform, kind of so that it feels like this is an on-brand person. You know, it's really just three-dimensional product tours, which make a traditional piece of software feel like buying French luxury.
Yeah.
I think that the heaviest lift in the future, and in kind of practical ways, I think this means that, you know, you can hire the marketing ops and the, you know, the AEO, SEO, GEO person, but if I were putting a bet, you know, someone asked me this the other day, you know, venture capitalists asked me this. They said, you know, Amit, if you were to hire three people in your AI future marketing team, right, what would you hire, right? And you know what?
Great
the
question.
First the first person I said to them is, I said, you know, this is a certain kind of creative producer. It's a new kind of creative producer that knows how to wield AI tools and creates, you know, bespoke content experiences. And then I said, the second person I'd hire is like a GTM engineer that knows how to rig the stack together. And said, the third person that I would hire is someone that actually knows how to throw a great party, like real world events that feel like salon, you know, style. And so I think that the answer is actually marketing. Like, marketing can elevate each one of these digital touch points in a way that now the decision maker that was not in the room, what they get back from you. Look, the practical ways to do this are still microsites or password protected things where, you know, but imagine if, you know, if at the end of this meeting, I got a note which said, hey, here's a 5-minute Alex narration. It could even be an audio narration of like what you missed in the meeting and kind of all be discussed. And, you know, and I'm simply like listening to it. You know, there's no reason to believe that won't be as powerful as here's an email which basically reads out the read.ai summary. I mean, that's, you know, so I
was beautiful. I think you're recruited for our advisory board at Relate To, because actually we do have the narration, audio narration product that we're kind of releasing. But I think that, like, to build on your, what you said is the key word to me is multimodal, because you don't really know, you know, which part of human is going to be showing up, right? Is it going to be the visual Amit who likes to look at the charts and you know, kind of like, it really, because a picture says 1,000 words, or it's going to be Amit that's going for a walk and he just like does not want to look at his screen because he's been looking at screens all day, but would like to have, you know, a short summary, and then like if that leads to something, drill into the one visual that he needs to on the walk, right? Or you have something that you could forward to your colleague out of the box that kind of is like ready to go, so it's right. Zero friction, right? So we don't like, we struggle, I think, right now to predict what these are. And so I think having some kind of a buyer experience center, for lack of a better word, that's deeply personalized, that kind of collects the latest things, right? That's adapts to you as a buyer on the fly. And you could have a very different need depending on which device you're on or which part of the sales cycle you're on. And then there's your colleagues, right? That could be caring about very different things, but they still need to be engaged. That I think has been the nirvana of like a proper sales process. And I do think the tools are getting in place. We're seeing it with our stack to address that. And that's what I'm hearing kind of be like on the kind of the sales people acting like marketers and then marketers acting like sellers because they could deeply personalize and get away from a vanilla message to something that is going to be relevant to that particular
and you
got to
get people into the product. You got to, right. If you get people into the product, I think this is
the third lever.
Right. Like even if one of the, your things, you know, around it is that, hey, I've sent you an email which says, hey, we've created a time box version for you with like, I don't know, 1,000 credits. And you can, I mean, if you think of what the AI tools have done really well, you know, the Claude, you know, Gemini variations, is that I think they just made it possible for us to throw a bunch of input in. Let me show you something interesting that can be done with this. And I think that even if you're selling an engineering software, like you're selling MATLAB for the 2027 era, there's no reason for you to not build a funnel of things that, you know, that people, you know, sort of, you sort of experience. I mean, intuitively we get this, right? When we go to the museums in Paris or DC or wherever else, right? Yeah. We get it that you need an open staging area where everybody can hang out and sort of have the taste of at least, you know, the pyramid or kind of, you know, not everyone has to sign up for, you know, get your guide. But I think the interesting thing about the content problem is that whether it's the first time you start looking, even when you're not even sure what you want to buy, all the way to, you know, what we covered earlier in our conversation about like the post sales, you know, customer engagement cycle. If the entire, you know, linchpin of technology products is that, you know, I need to model a 5 to 10x LTV for Alex over a period of time, I mean, you're not going to drive any of that LTV unless the product that they're already using, they're getting the most out of that product. And the next upsell, cross-sell you do with them, you know, you're actually walking alongside them and helping them get value out of that also. I mean, if in many ways, the reason software valuation multiples are compressed right now is because a lot of the math on LTV and TCV is, it just smells funny because, you know, people are saying, I already have enough. And, you know, do I really need more software? And I actually think the answer is the world needs more software, but the only connective thread, and, you know, this isn't like a pitch for the CMO role of the future, right? But if you think about it, I think what you and I have seen with like the world's best CMOs is that, you know, they're really like aware that you have to look at your regulated industry product or your traditional agentic product or whatever, the way the world's best consumer brands think about customer lifecycle. And I think that's where the only role that can really go up funnel, mid funnel, bottom funnel, cross funnel, late funnel, and then, you know, dead funnel. And then you got to like bring those people, kind of reanimate them and bring them back into the fold again, is actually marketing. And I think that the chances of the marketer becoming like a CRMO or whatever those things are, CMRO, just as there are more CPMOs today. But I think, you know, that's that's one part piece of the puzzle. And the second piece of the puzzle is you just like, you know, like technologies like yours, you need to think like that for every single persona in your, you know, your current and future ICP, because that way you're creating these you've created these beautiful ungated journeys.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
For when you're not in the room, and that's,
yeah,
you know, that's nirvana.
What I think is beautiful, and I'll just start wrapping up, but the you're talking about a new type of CMO, right? Like you're a product guy that have been a CMO, that have talked to customers and sold things as a GM, right? And that is a mix of obviously like way more sophisticated marketing, but also the mentality around how does product do more of the selling? And then again, powering sales with marketing, and then bringing the insight that the best sellers have into the marketing experiences that you create to create the Paris, you know, Paris museum experience with a personal guide that's serving you macaroons as you're consuming and kind of imagining your future, right? Like you're bringing all that in one place. And I think that is a very unique skill set. So my answer to that VC that was asking you about who are the three people that you need to bring on is bring on Amit, and then he'll figure it out. So good to have you on. So good to share all your experience and lessons learned across the journey. Any last words on how people could engage and find you, you know, online, and you know what? Any parting wisdom as we wrap up today?
People can find me online on you know, LinkedIn and sometimes X, and always happy to connect with you know, folks with a shared passion for, you know, content, next generation storytelling in UX, and of course, you know, all things sort of agentic and AI. And you know, the closing thought I'll share with you sort of connects to, you know, where you and I started a conversation, is that this is probably the most profound period of identity shifts for not just, you know, not just those of us in tech, but also those of us not in tech and likely to be affected by AI in some, you know, form or the other. And I think that, you know, with where we're going, especially with the future of go-to-market, you know, I have this optimistic take that AI will help us. It may cause a sugar crash and an identity crash in the short term. It's quite possible that, you know, we might look back at AI's output and say, oh my God, you know, this is better than the best class project I did at GSB, or this is better than, you know, the best strategy report I ever wrote in a company. But I actually think that if we go far back enough, right, and I, you know, think back, like when I say long, far back enough, I think of like 100 years ago, the kinds of things Isaac Asimov and other folks like that were writing. I think there's a reason to be bullish that 80% of the work that we have done, even us, right, that we have done in our work lives. And if I went back to that 80%, I would say, yeah, actually, I don't know if, you know, that 80% was really as valuable. And I think that if we can embrace AI, not just kind of at the, you know, the McKinsey LinkedIn level of like, you know, intellectually feeling what's happening, but
yeah,
the way I'm trying to challenge myself now is, I think there's a way you're challenging yourself with Claude Code, is that, you know, let's just go right at the grassroots of this, because in the process of learning AI and becoming more hands-on with these tools ourselves, perhaps ground up a new kind of identity will emerge for us, whether we are in our like 40s or 50s, and then this will make for a smarter, lighter, more interesting version of us. So I'm, in the medium term to long term, I'm more bullish with AI. In the extreme short term, I think it's going to be a little bit crazy. But you know, I encourage everyone to take it as an opportunity to redefine that new identity. And who knows, the next time you and I do this formally, like, you know, we'll have figured out another new hat in that new identity. So I'll kind of leave you with that.
I'll send my avatar for the next one. I mean,
yes. Maybe it'll be our avatar talking to each other next time.
Beautiful. Thank you, Amit, for joining us and sharing your wisdom.
Thank you so much, Alex.
Whoa.
Welcome back. Alex Shevelenko here. Thank you so much for listening to Experience Focused Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at podcast.relayto.com, R-E-L-Y-T-O.com. Obviously, we would love for you to send this to people that you know who would be great speakers, or just share the nuggets that you took away from this episode with your community on social. And you could learn more about what we're up to on relayto.com. You could certainly connect with me on LinkedIn, where it's just very easy to spell my name. You have to have a master's in Ukrainian. It's Shevelenko, S-H-E-V-L-E-N-K-O. Would love to connect so that we can move together the way the world communicates about its most important ideas. Thank you for listening. We hope to see you next time.